Hey guys, we just want to mention that we talk about different health topics in this podcast. As we are not experts, we would ask for you to check with your doctor first before trying any of the things that we suggest in this podcast. Thanks. Additionally, we also talk about third-party views and other related topics in this podcast. Please know that we have no intention of misrepresenting them. If we do, however, we apologize in advance. Thank you. And we're back with another episode of the Contemplation Hypothesization. Paul?
Hey guys, what's up?
Today we're talking about psychology.
Yeah, basically I minored in psychology. Honestly, I didn't get too much from my minor in psychology, but I was really interested in it, so I've read all of the classes' works of psychology. So today we're just going to delve into some of those and talk about what I find to be practical from those.
Awesome. Okay, Paul, so what maybe is a couple key points that you've learned from these that you want to maybe say that maybe most people don't know?
Okay, well, I think the best way to start this would be to look at the different types of therapies. I think that there's different stuff that can come from each therapy. Right now, in psychology, the most popular form of therapy is cognitive behavioral therapy. And the reason why it's the most popular is because it's the most cost-effective. And the reason why that is because it's the treatment that works the fastest. So that means you pay fewer visits and get more immediate results. Now, personally, I think cognitive therapy is awesome and stuff. But I am more interested, actually, in more of the old-school psychology that came before that.
Can you kind of break down for us what cognitive therapy is? Exactly is that?
Okay, so cognitive therapy. There's cognitive therapy and cognitive behavioral therapy. They're both pretty similar. But it's a therapy where the patient and the psychologist work on, you know, becoming aware of thought processes and how those affect the body and behavior. And then they work through changing these. One of the things that the psychologist determines is where you have cognitive fallacies. And those are things that like ways in which you think that hurt yourself, that make you feel worse about yourself, that are more bad than good. So take, for example, a common one is, an example is fortune telling. And what fortune telling is when a person hangs out with a group of people, for example, they think that they know what the other people are thinking about them with
exact precision.
With precision and certainty. And oftentimes, it's the error is that the assumption that other people think the way you do, because it's often not that case. Most people don't have the same thoughts as you do in a social situation. So, for example, let's say that you're singing karaoke and you make yourself look like an idiot. Someone who fortune tells maybe assumes that Bob in the room was just going on and on about how stupid they were and all this stuff. And it's just an assumption which may or may not be true. And so when you have something that may or may not be true, there's no reason to think the worst case scenario because you're ultimately just hurting yourself. You're making yourself feel worse for no reason. So a cognitive therapist goes through and you find these different cognitive errors in your thinking and you slowly work on changing these. And they have, there's a couple of books, like David Burns has a book called Feeling Good, and he goes through the list of cognitive fallacies. And so the way that you come up with the good thing is I think that they've modeled cognitive therapy after people who are really happy and don't make these errors. Someone who's really good with people isn't going to fortune tell. They're not constantly assuming that these people don't like them or think these bad things about them. They may even fortune tell in a different way, maybe think more positively.
Yeah, so the normal healthy person, are they always just projecting best case scenarios as opposed to worst case?
Yeah, ultimately the goal of cognitive behavioral therapy is to mimic someone who is really healthy and successful among people and relationships.
Okay. Gotcha. Okay, so that was cognitive therapy.
That's cognitive therapy. And so cognitive therapy, like I said, is just extremely cost-effective. Old forms of psychotherapy, which had its groundwork from Freud, are long processes that ultimately may or may not solve your problems. So you're going to end up going to hundreds of visits over the years, and you may or may not make any progress.
And that's the traditional psychotherapy.
Visits, that's the original one that Freud came up with. Freud wasn't the first to create the field of psychology. Actually, William Henry was, who was a philosopher, but Freud was the first person to bring the therapy aspect into psychology. After Freud, people began paying money to have visits with psychologists.
Okay, gotcha. And then, so with this cognitive psychology treatment, is that something you can do yourself, or is it
Actually, there's been a lot of studies on it, on whether the therapy can be done without a therapist. And what they do is they give people a book like Feeling Good by David Burns.
Yeah.
And then they give people treatment, and then they give people placebo. And at the end of the treatment, actually, people who have read the book do just as well as people who actually get the therapy.
The regular traditional psychology.
No, we're talking about cognitive therapy.
Okay, gotcha.
So
okay.
What we're identifying is whether a book and doing a self-therapy.
The self-therapy is just as good as the cognitive therapy with a person.
And so at the end of the day, ultimately, you can just read a book and work on the stuff yourself. But what's really important is that you have like a regime, a working regime of like things to work on and stuff. The problem with a lot of people who read books is they skip a lot of parts of books and they get kind of unfocused and they don't really spend the time they need to on certain fallacies. But I think the study controlled for that. Like the people who read the books followed everything in the book. So if you read a book and follow the stuff in the book, you definitely reap the benefits of the book.
Okay, so let me ask you this. Is it more, because I think for myself at least that, you know, the thoughts that you have form into actions, but also the actions you do influence your thoughts.
Right.
So is that exactly what cognitive therapy is doing? You're like acting out as if you are like very socially adept, but you are very happy, and then that thus makes you happy?
Yeah. I think an assumption that cognitive behavioral therapists make is that your thoughts cause your actions. Older forms of psychology want to say that your actions caused your thoughts, that they followed, that they weren't in the chain of causation.
Yeah.
So that your thoughts could be understood. If you understood your thoughts, you could then start to understand your actions.
Right. But I think it's a cycle. It's like your thoughts do influence your actions, but
yeah,
then your actions do influence your thoughts.
Yeah, and there's been studies that, for example, like someone who imitates like good body language, like, you know, big posture and stuff, begins feeling better. Like there's even a study where they had people fake smile in a mirror, and
okay.
They started releasing dopamine and started feeling happier. So definitely the emotions that you put on your face affect the inner, what you feel inside, and vice versa. What is inside affects what's outside.
Gotcha.
So
you can,
that's where the behavioral therapy comes in. You know, things like smiling more. You know, smiling, obviously people can detect like an insincere smile, but as you fake smile, your body actually starts to smile for real and you start to feel that inner stuff. So it's important to recognize that the inner and the outside both affect each other, and cognitive therapy focuses more on the inner, while cognitive behavioral therapy fits both the inner and outer.
Yeah.
Cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, is often used more for, you know, phobias of things, like where you have behavior problems and things of that nature.
Okay, yeah, actually one thing I wanted to comment on, I mean, just I think a lot of people recognize like the long-term brat syndrome, as like I like to call it, where if you the silence treatment, like if you are angry against somebody, like you won't directly say it, but you'll just indirectly not be happy when they are around.
Right, yeah.
But the thing is that's actually really killing you, because you're just acting out as if you're not happy, which then causes you to become a little bit unhappy. And if you do this, you know, continuously, every time that you're upset at somebody,
builds habits.
Yeah.
And that's another important part of cognitive behavioral therapy, is a habit aspect. Ultimately, you have these habits, like thought habits, where you, when a certain situation happens, you have a habit of this forming. And sometimes these bad habits are formed from bad environments, sometimes even uncaused. You can have a great family, but in high school, maybe people were mean to you, and then you started forming these habits. It's important also, though, to recognize the important nature of these, why these habits came into existence. Like we all like to think that bullying is really bad. You know, it's really mean to bully someone. But in our society, bullying is like a way to help someone learn sometimes their actions are out of place or wrong.
Right. Okay.
And so some of these thoughts form by accident, and they shouldn't form, but it's also ultimately coming from a good process where a person's behavior is being shaped in order to fit better into society. So
okay.
we're going back to those bad habits that formed, reshaping them, but we still keep the learned behavior that came from those experiences.
Okay, gotcha. So, like, you know, with bullying, I mean, we don't really have that. I mean, in high school, it's much more obvious, and in grade school, it's even more obvious. But I think we still actually do have it in when you get older, in, like, the work environment.
Oh, yeah.
What are your strategies to combat that, or how do you deal with that?
Okay, well, bullying's a really interesting field because, for one, it's interesting how bullying does shape behavior, sometimes in positive ways. But it can also, like, although it may stop you from doing a behavior that is inappropriate, it may then go on to form these bad cognitive errors in your thinking and stuff. I've like helped different people with bullying. I think everybody has been bullied to some extent. A smart bully is somewhat passive aggressive, like you were saying. There's a great book called Games People Play. People play a lot of games, like you were mentioning, like the silent treatment and stuff. They play games with each other to manipulate behavior, and that sort of stuff is going on all the time. The book actually will go over a lot of behaviors that games that people play in order to manipulate your behavior. But bullying is a really interesting phenomenon because pretty much every single one of us has flaws that are noticeable to other people. You know, some people are too short, some people are too tall, some people, you know, are good looking, some people aren't, and et cetera. And in a high school atmosphere, almost everybody embodies some flaws. So you have to ask, why are some people getting bullied and other people aren't? Like, why are there some cool kids that have these clear flaws, but they're not getting bullied, while these other people continue to get bullied with the same flaws? And it comes down to, what is the motive behind bullying? Why do people bully other people? And the reason why people bully other people is specifically for the reaction that they get. They feel a sense of superiority over someone else. And some psychologists have said that a huge human motive is feeling a sense of superiority and avoiding a sense of inferiority. And so a bully's objective is to get a reaction out of their victim. So however they do this, they may do it physically, they may do it mentally, which is more common, they will do it. And as long as they get that reaction, they will continue to bully that person. Now, if let's take an example of like a high school situation. Let's say a bully goes up to a cool kid and they say, "You're weird." The cool kid says, "I don't really care. Doesn't like, why would I care that you call me weird? I'm like way cooler than you are." So, so it doesn't work. It doesn't work. So yeah. The bully's not going to try to bully that kid again, because the guy has enough confidence in himself to know that what the bully is saying is not really an attack on who he is as a person. Even though it might be true, the bully doesn't has no success. Now the bully goes up to the kid that is feeling kind of insecure about himself, and he says, "You're weird." And the kid, you know, has been trained through years of different bully programs, which I think are awful, to, you know, either go tell a teacher, to fight back, to argue back and stuff like that. And all this stuff is counterproductive. As soon as you fight back, you're giving that reaction that the bully wants, because the bully is going to be on top of you no matter what, because you ultimately, like, a lot of people try to snap back with better comebacks and stuff, and it just doesn't work, because they have this feeling that they're being bullied, and they already feel inferior from that, and the bully doesn't have to put much effort into, you know, win the battle.
So what's the strategy? What's the bottom line strategy?
So the strategy is to first recognize that everybody has flaws, and it's not the flaws. The flaws are not the reason that you're getting bullied.
It's the fact that they want to feel superior.
It's the fact that you're giving a reaction of inferiority to the person. And so in the same sense that cognitive behavioral therapy attempts to fix these cognitive errors, someone who's trying to help someone avoid being bullied will fix these errors. And so the errors are that you actually feel inferior because of this bullying. The way the cool kid responds is the way everyone should respond. Like, just don't give a reaction.
Just like, "Oh, that's nice," and just walk away or something.
And now here's like a little beware though for people who do have this problem, is if you are being bullied by someone and you immediately start not giving a reaction and not caring, then what a bully will always do is take it up a notch. They will try to get you back under their control, and you have to stick with it, be persistent through it until they stop. Now, I think that it's important also to recognize that there's a big difference between physical bullying and mental bullying. Physical bullying is a much more complicated issue that needs to be dealt with, because you can't just not give a reaction. They're just gonna, like, when you're getting beat up, you can't just not react.
Right.
You're gonna feel inferior. But mental bullying and things like that, that's where this is going to be really useful. But yeah, beware that when you stop giving a reaction, that things are going to crank up a notch. But what you'll see is that they'll crank up a notch, and if you continue to not give a reaction, they will find a new prey to go on.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. I mean, like, the mental bullying, that is really just a game to me, because it's just their thoughts make you think who you are. So, I mean, at that point, it's just a thought battle. And thoughts can physically change you, but I you're still, you know, you still can function. You still have all your arms and limbs and everything. You know, you can do all your daily tasks and stuff like that. Rather, it's like them implanting a seed in you and you constantly thinking about the comment that they said. But if you don't even think about it, then it won't affect you at all. But
yeah, and it's easier said than done. Like, say, not think about something. Like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You probably will think about it. But that's why I think it's important to recognize that you're not being bullied because something's wrong with you. There's something wrong with nearly everybody else. Everybody has something wrong with them. There's people who have tons wrong with them. Like, there's, like, the guy from Game of Thrones. You know, he's a midget, but, you know, he's cool, and, like, people don't bully him and stuff. I'm not saying that being a midget warrants that, but I'm just saying it's, like, clearly he's different than other people. It's not that you're different that you're getting bullied. The reason why you're getting bullied is because you're giving a reaction.
Gotcha. Okay. All right, great. So just switching topics, I know there were a couple other psycho...
Yeah. So I mentioned cognitive behavioral therapy is really popular right now, and the area was interesting to me, but I just didn't find it to be totally full... I don't know how to describe it, but to me, the area of cognitive behavioral therapy is still far underdeveloped, and there's still a lot of questions and aspects of the human psyche that cognitive behavioral therapy is not able to answer. And the biggest thing is probably that I want to discuss is the failure of self-analysis and why self-analysis is often so ineffective. And to get into that, I want to first give like a little brief history of psychology. As we know, as I mentioned before, William Henry, a philosopher in the 1800s, late 1800s, started the field of psychology, and then it was Freud and Adler, and there was this group of like maybe 5 MDs who met every weekend to discuss the human psyche. And Freud is obviously the most famous of them, although because his ideas are the most bizarre. But the other people who worked with him also had some great ideas that were less bizarre, but because of that, they're less famous. And during that period, there started to form a field of study around things like the I, the superego, and the ego, which are pretty common terms in psychology classes nowadays. And that period was kind of weird. Like, you had, like, the anal fixation, like, this weird stuff, which, you know, today all we can do a lot of studies to show that a lot of Freud's work is not accurate. But what really interested me when I was reading psychology stuff was what came after Freud. They're called Neo-Freudians.
Okay.
And my favorite was Karen Horney. Actually, Freud's daughter was also a very good psychologist. But the field really went from the bizarre Freud into probably the most intellectual the field of psychology has been. I don't want to like insult anyone who's in it now, but the field now is full of like false positives. Not that it wasn't then, but back then it was more like in-depth theory about how the human mind worked. Now we're doing a lot of studies, and it's you know, cognitive therapy is great, but I don't feel like it has the same depthness to what the Neo-Freuds had in their work. So the Neo-Freuds were from around like the 1930s to the 1960s. And then after them, you also have a really fascinating period in psychology where you had social psychology with Zimbardo, Zimbardo's prison experiment, and the social experiments. But you also had the humanist psychology perspective, and you had some great ideas from that. So I'll talk about the humanist perspective later and talk about some of the cool ideas that contributed. But I want to mainly focus on the Neo-Freud age, which is an age that's often overlooked, which I find surprising because I think some of the best stuff comes from that.
Okay.
So Karen Horney wrote a book called Self-Analysis, and it was basically about the failure of self-analysis. So
okay.
The reason why someone can benefit from a therapist and why a lot of problems can't be solved through like personal problem solving. Now, there definitely are problems that can be solved. Like cognitive therapy is an aspect where a person, if they really sit down, they can have the self-awareness to determine which thoughts are hurting them and then slowly work towards eliminating those thought behaviors.
Okay.
But there's like a more modern term for the problem that exists with self-analysis are blind spots.
Okay.
Blind spots is the word that's often thrown around nowadays, but it's the idea that someone can be completely blind to their flaws when it's completely evident to other people.
Okay, yeah.
And the reason why they're completely blind was theorized by these Neo-Freuds, who said that, you know, it's the ego protecting, shielding the person from the truth.
Okay.
Because admitting to the truth could make you unhappy and make you feel inferior.
Because you have these flaws.
Because you have these flaws, but your body and your subconscious is constantly trying to avoid facing the truths of certain realities, and so you avoid them. I'm trying to think what Freud's term was for this. Well, defense mechanisms is one of the big things. Our body emits like defense mechanisms. Subconscious emits these defense mechanisms that prevent us from seeing stuff.
Okay.
And I think that this is a huge part of psychology that today is overlooked and is really important to making actual changes to yourself. So just to talk about blind spots briefly, consider, for example, a friend who every group has a friend who's just really, you know, weird and his behavior just is not socially intelligent. Now, think about how many times in your group someone has like sat down with him and really talked to him about why his behavior is wrong. Sure, there's some groups where that does happen and that's good, but what the normal behavior is among groups is that people don't tend to tell other people their flaws. My dad works in a position of power and stuff, and it's really self-evident when you have power. What happens when you have power is that no one has the guts to tell you what's wrong with you. So someone with power walks in the room and they're like, how did I do on this? There's very few people that will give them honest feedback because that power scares them, and they don't want to fear losing their job. The same thing happens on a smaller, like in smaller social circles, even without that power, is that people don't want to insult other people because it comes across bad upon themselves.
Right.
And it's not really insulting. Like a lot of times this stuff can be done constructively, but at the same time, like we are afraid of like damaging the person's like self-identity by telling them by pointing these things out.
Yeah.
And you know, I think this is ultimately why, if you look at like past leaders, like monarchs and stuff, why they really appreciated honest people, honest feedback. You know, they'd have people they go to who they knew would always tell them the truth, because most people in their kingdom would tell them whatever they thought that the king wanted to hear.
Right. Okay.
And so in a social group, the same thing happens. Someone can do something that everyone blatantly likes, and no one will mention it. But as soon as that person's gone, everyone gossips.
I mean, dislikes. Yeah.
Dislikes. Yeah. And then everybody gossips. And that's one of the ways gossiping forms, is that people don't tell people directly what the problem they have with them, because they don't want to hurt their own image, because you hurt your own image when you start attacking people like that. And secondly, what happens a lot of times when you do tell someone about one of their flaws is that these defense mechanisms like kick off like crazy. The person goes into denial. Yeah. They refuse to believe that what you're saying is true. They'll convince you that like, oh, you don't understand why they're like this and that, which may be the case. And that's another reason why it's not a good idea to like always be so honest, is because maybe you don't understand. Maybe their sense of humor is funny to everybody except for you. And
right.
So you don't have like the authority to really tell them that.
Yeah.
I think someone who recognizes that these blind spots do exist is going to be more willing to listen to the feedback of other people, realizing how powerful it is. But as I said, like in a small social dynamic, people will not tell you what your flaws are. And so you can go on and on in your life. Most people live their entire life with these very clear flaws that everybody who encounters them notices, but no one tells them. So you're actually kind of doing them a disservice. But the thing is that you have these few people that tell them, and then when you tell them, defense mechanisms pop off,
right?
And the person can't accept it.
So for the very few honest insults that you get, don't defend them. Actually, listen to them.
Listen. Try to listen to them. Yeah, it's going to be hard, and you're going to recognize these defense mechanisms popping off like crazy. But this actually leads into another really interesting area of psychology that was even more developed in the 80s than it was in the 30s, and that's self-acceptance. And I think self-acceptance is one of the keys to defeating these defense mechanisms. And I think it's really important to come more to grips with reality, because how can you analyze yourself when you don't see yourself the way that you actually are?
Seen, yeah.
That gets us into the topic of self-acceptance and why self-acceptance is so incredibly important. There was a quote, I don't know it verbatim, but it was basically the idea is that we can't change until we accept who we are. Because before we accept who we are just changing a arbitrary, like, kind of imaginative person. But once we accept who we truly are, then we can change. And maybe I can explain that a little bit better. But let's say that you're an alcoholic. And that's the common one that's used in AA, is that you're an alcoholic, but you don't admit to yourself you're an alcoholic, because being an alcoholic has these negative connotations that you don't want to accept.
Yeah,
you know, it means that you, like, screwed up, that you're making mistakes on a daily basis and different things like that. So most people who are alcoholics are initially in denial that they are an alcoholic. And they go to AA and they're like, I'm not an alcoholic, I just like to drink alcohol every once in a while and stuff.
Right.
And they go on and on, but they can't change themselves in any way thinking that they're not an alcoholic, because they're not accepting that they actually have a behavior problem that's wrong, so there's no initiative to change. Or if they do change something, it's not something that actually will help them, because the big problem remains, they're an alcoholic. So that's why in AA, it's incredibly important to first accept that you're an alcoholic and accept the reality of a situation before you can move beyond it. One thing that, like, I dealt with a lot was, like, in high school, I had a lot of anxiety. Like, it kind of just hit me during, like, adolescence. I just started getting anxiety really bad. And I was constantly in denial that I had anxiety.
Okay, yeah.
Like, I just wanted to tell myself, I just kept telling myself, it's not anxiety, it's not bad, and stuff like that. And it wasn't until I finally accepted the fact that I had anxiety and, like, looked at myself and looked at, like, what that meant, that I actually had it, that I was actually able to then take my situation and look for a solution to get rid of it.
Gotcha.
Because I just kept putting it off. I wasn't really, if I was fixing problems, it wasn't the right problem. It wasn't the core problem that existed.
So, okay, so I have a question. Like, I mean, for me at least, you know, I'm planning on going to medical school and everything, and that is just like an anxiety inducer.
Yeah.
So how did you overcome your anxiety and still function normally and still get things done without worrying about exams and stuff like that?
Yeah. Okay, well, first off, I think it's really important that people gauge how bad their anxiety actually is, because there's a lot of, anti-drugs, antidepressants, and so people are, like, really against taking that stuff because you don't know what the side effects could be long term. But there are a lot of drugs out there that have been used for years, and the studies have not seen, like, any, like, really bad side effects. So for people who have really severe cases, definitely go to a psychiatrist and get the medication you need, because those will help you a lot.
Right. Okay.
And they'll make your life a lot better than they hurt your life in the end. It's more important that you live with less anxiety than, you know, maybe develop something minor down the road because of the medication. So first off, you know, gauge how much it is and then decide whether you should go to a doctor or not. But in terms of self-improvement, I think the first way is to really gauge the core problem. Like, what is the reason that you have this anxiety? Like, try to take it back all the way to things. Like, Freud would always say, like, figure out what thing in childhood caused it. I don't agree with that. I don't think it's important to shape it all the way back to childhood. I think what's important is figuring out, like, why now you have this anxiety problem. Like, what is the core reasons that you have it? And, like, what we were talking about before, first off, you have to totally look at yourself as objectively as possible. Like,
yeah.
You need to take other people's feedback and actually look at it. You need to start, I think meditation's huge because it gives you the ability to act as an observer to yourself.
Right.
So I think people should sit down and just kind of meditate and listen to their thoughts, like, pay attention to what they're thinking and stuff. And when they're doing that too, they can kind of work on the cognitive therapy, you know, like, what thoughts are hurting me, what thoughts are good for me. And then from there, like, identifying the core problem is huge. To me, I think the big core problem is actually, like, an enlarged ego. Like, an enlarged ego is actually a really common problem. It's like, I had to be the best at everything I did. Like, I couldn't lose at one thing. Yeah, you know, I had to beat, like, when I was younger, like, if I lost in a sprint, I would be mad at myself and I'd have to win that sprint. I'd practice until I won. And that sort of behavior is arguably okay for certain things. Like, it's good to, you know, succeed and work hard and do better. But when your core motivation is, like, neurotic, like, when you just work harder because you hate yourself sort of thing, or you want to be perfect. That's a problem. So perfectionism was the first problem identified.
And that would that cause anxiety for you?
Yes. And then that's the point, is like this core problem of having a big ego and having being a perfectionist was what was causing anxiety for me.
Because when you couldn't become perfect, you would get anxiety from that.
Yeah. So like when I messed up around other people, which was common because anxiety messes you up, then I would get really angry about myself.
Yeah, and you might worry, like, if you're going to go on stage or something, you're going to take an exam, you might mess up, which would then ruin your perfect record, which then makes you anxious for the actual performance or exam, which then decreases your performance.
Right, yeah. And so you find out what the core is, especially when it's a problem. Like, also recognize that anxiety is a normal human behavior. Like, television, well, we get a lot of information from television about social behavior, and in television, there's no anxiety. Like, no one has anxiety in movies. No one has anxiety on TV. But in reality, a lot of people have anxiety.
Right.
We get the impression that anxiety is a really bad thing, but it's just kind of different people have different amounts of anxiety. It's kind of an evolved trait for survival.
Yeah.
Worrying about things is a good thing when it protects you and stuff. And maybe in our age, a lot of our worry has no use to it.
Yeah. Well, just a science interruption real quick. One thing is a lot of like evolutionists believe that with worry, it's a good thing when it comes in spurts. So like you get really worried when you're about to get eaten by an animal, and so you run away, and then thing is that amount of time is probably like 10 minutes tops in total. Mm-hmm. So you're like adrenaline rushed worried for like those 10 minutes, and then for maybe a day or 2 days you rest and you're fine, you're not worried at all. But that's like the complete opposite of what today's society is.
Yeah.
It's like you have a little bit of worry about all these things, and they just are chronic, and they last more than days. They can last weeks, months. You might get a notification that, like, you know, the company is firing employees. You don't know when they're firing them. It could be a week from now, 3 months from now. You guys start looking for another job. The job market's getting closed in. That's a chronic worry. You never had that type of situation like during evolution times. Mm-hmm. So we're not really built to deal with chronic worrying. And there's all these different psychological and physical effects that chronic worrying can do to you. These certain hormones are released in different proportions, and it's just a terrible. It's one of the worst things you can do to destroy your body. Yeah.
Well, that's awesome that you've like to add that to this. The fight or flight response is like the thing that people often use to describe it. And like you were saying, like it doesn't make sense to go into a fight or flight response just because you have to give a speech in front of people.
Right.
You're not going to get killed by anything. Jerry Seinfeld does a joke that people would rather be in the casket than the person giving the eulogy at the funeral. Which is so funny.
Yeah.
So the other thing that I think is really important in defeating stress and anxiety is diet and exercise. Diet is one of the most overlooked things in our society, but our diets are terrible, and they're often, you know, like replete in corn syrups and things that are notoriously bad for our brains. And so I think that diet has a crucial role in sort of this epidemic of anxiety and stress. I think people just eat terrible diets. And so one thing I'd recommend is finding a diet, like a balanced diet, and sticking to it. Something simple and ordinary, and just eat it often. I cannot believe the amount of like reduced stress that comes from a good diet and exercise. That alone, like before anyone seeks any treatment or medication, they need to be working out. The problem that a lot of people face though is that they're pessimistic about exercise and diet because they don't think it will help them and stuff.
Right.
And so oftentimes that's when a drug can help someone, because the drug can kind of give them this feeling of getting better, and then they get back into things like motivation. But that's like when it depends on like the extremity of the condition is, but definitely like don't be afraid to seek doctors. Like a lot of self-help people are really against like prescriptions and stuff, but you like in psychology they have helped thousands of people like a lot. So
I think there's a lot of from at least my background, my understanding is that I too would want to use a drug as the very last option, because there are different side effects and there's a lot of effects that we simply just don't know about. Mm-hmm. And of course you want to ask your psychiatrist first, and they probably will recommend other alternatives first before using a drug.
Yeah, and they will tell you to start exercising, they'll tell you to get the diet, and they'll tell you to get cognitive therapy.
Yeah.
And I think that what's important is gauging whether the anxiety you live with is really so bad that those side effects from the bad anxiety are worse than a medication side effects.
Yeah, right.
Now, there's kind of on the notes of cognitive therapy is, I remember listening to an interview of Tiger Woods, and a young kid asked him, like, how does he deal with the intense pressure of winning a golf tournament? I mean, golf is notoriously one of the most stressful sports there is. One little mess up in your swing could cost you a tournament.
Yeah.
And Tiger Woods said, he's like, stress is fun. Like, I enjoy it. And I think that that's a perspective that people who are really healthy have. Not that Tiger Woods is necessarily like really emotionally healthy or anything, but it's a characteristic that people who are successful have, is that they like enjoy stress. You're going to always have anxiety. You're going to have like anxiety approaching people you don't know. It's just natural and stuff. But some people can approach people they don't know all the time because they enjoy that feeling. And it's something that you can learn to enjoy too. like physical pain, for example, like take something like Marine boot camp, like, or like let's say Hell Week, the Navy SEAL Hell Week. People are able to get through incredibly harsh training because they can learn to observe these feelings that they have. They can observe their anxiety, they can observe their pain, they can observe the coldness, and then they can not let it affect them. And I think that's a skill set that everybody should work on developing. Things like lifting weights, like the best bodybuilders in the world, those sets are incredibly hard that they're doing. They learn to love that pain, and anyone can do that. And I think someone who has anxiety must learn to enjoy anxiety, because anxiety can actually be on your side. Like, I found a lot of times when I was really anxious for a situation that I do a lot better. Some anxiety is better. It's good because it gives you energy and stuff like that.
Right.
So Nick mentioned that he kind of wanted to talk a little bit with me about some of the 80s psychology, Milgram and Zimbardo. Milgram did an obedience psychology experiment where there was like an electrical... It was the setup situation where there's a guy in the room and his electrical board, and each knob increased the amount of electricity that would be sent to the other person. And Milgram wanted to show that people would follow obedience to the point that they would almost kill this guy.
Okay, but the guy in the other room is just a fake actor.
The guy is just a fake actor who like makes noises and makes the person believe that they're actually shocking him. So what happened was, like, I think it was like 60% of people went all the way to the end.
Oh.
Even when the person in the other room was yelling, like, don't, like, I think I might have a heart attack, they still did it because the authority told them to do it.
Wow.
And when they asked the authority, like, are you sure I can do this? The authority would say yes. And so it kind of took responsibility off of the person hitting it and threw it on the authority. So Milgram's and Zimbardo's experiments were ultimately thrown at trying to understand how Nazi Germany happened. How could all of these people who weren't, like, bad people follow this system of authority dogmatically? And Zimbardo's experiment was similar. It actually had to end early because of how bad the situations got. But he had like 20 random people selected, and he assigned half of them to be prison guards and half of them to be prisoners. And the prisoners were supposed to be treated as prisoners, and the prison guards were supposed to act as prison guards. And I think they did this for like maybe 4 days before they had to shut down. But what they saw was that people really took on the role that they were given. The same thing happens in a classroom. A teacher takes on the classroom. That power is somewhat arbitrary. The students give it to the teacher. It's not real power. A lot of power is arbitrary.
Yeah.
And so when they started acting like prison guards, they started to get this power. And then they started to abuse it. And apparently, people who were the prisoners, you know, were just freaking out, like becoming helpless, like just crying all day. And people were miserable. And that's why they had to stop the experiment. But it was just to show that when we assign roles to people, like this guy is the manager of our group, this guy is the boss, the people take on the roles and it really affects the situation. These arbitrary roles like actually affect reality.
Yeah, wow. Okay, so it's like a human construct, like when you're working in a company or something like that. And then what happens is the boss, that guy who's high up, you act much differently to, and you give all this power, which technically really doesn't exist. Like, you know, if you were an alien looking down from like space or something like that, you just see some people interacting.
They're just two people, yeah.
Yeah, like they're just like, why is one guy acting so like submissively in comparison to the other guy?
Has like this, yeah. I think it's important for everyone to, you know, become aware of these experiments. For one, to avoid dangerous obedience. You know, sometimes obedience is dangerous. And two, you know, to stop letting authority stress you out so much. Just recognize that authority is ultimately arbitrary, and it's just another person just like you. Certain personality types are already like that. Certain personality types are common that develop. They have no respect for authority, ultimately, because they don't see that arbitrary power that people have. Others are more submissive because they do. A lot of people say that the Germans' culture was a very submissive culture that follows rules. And if you look there now, they have a ton of rules that everyone follows, and people are very afraid of breaking those rules. So there's certain personality types that are more obedient than others. And I think for the people who are overly obedient, it's useful to look at the reality of the situation. That this is just another person. This is my boss, but he's just another person. This power he has is arbitrary. I don't need to necessarily act submissive to him. We can benefit more from a normal acting. And submissive behavior is actually a fascinating area of psychology. Like, different tonalities that people speak with is very evident. So, like, you give someone a boss tonality and they're going to, like, deepen their voice, they're going to have better posture and stuff. Always, like, overpower. So, like, when you give them this arbitrary power, it actually changes who they are. And then people who are in the opposite situation have more submissive body language, more submissive tonality. One thing I've heard for people who have a problem with being overly submissive is to keep your voice tonality neutral. You know, like, if you're going to talk to, like, your grandma, you'd be like, hey, grandma, like, how are you doing? And you'd, like, raise the pitch of your voice, like, kind of upward. If you're talking down to someone, like, which I don't recommend really ever. I don't know, like, what situation would call for that. But you'd be like, get down. Like, you'd deepen your voice and make it louder and more parrying. But a neutral voice is just like we're talking about now. Just keep your voice the same, and ultimately that kind of creates a neutral respect for each other.
So the submissive voice is a higher pitched tone? Okay.
And a submissive voice is not a bad voice. I mean, like, doctors should use it, like, when they're trying to understand. Like, when you're listening to someone and you really, like, I think it's important to have that. But, you know, if you're going up to someone in an interview and you're like, you know, like, hi, how are you doing? People don't really like being spoken to that way.
Yeah.
And they will take on the role of being the more dominant person. But if you just go up and, like, hey, what's up, and, like, shake their hand and just that neutral, yeah, then they will, like, respect you more. And so body language and tonality is important to, you know, like, how people think of and respect you.
Gotcha. That's okay. Okay, so basically, like, for these, I mean, you could also apply that to dating, too, I guess.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, you know. Actually, that's a problem that a lot of guys have, is that they act really submissive to, like, women, and women don't find that very attractive. They should act more neutral in going about it. Like a lot of times, that's, like, a really quick fix for guys, is they just change the tonality of their voice, and then they start embodying characteristics of more of, like, a powerful person, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, but we should probably stress that it's a neutral, you know, everyone's neutral. On the same level.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you want everyone to be on the same. You don't want to put people on pedestals. You want to just think of everyone the same. Like, I can't stress how important that is. I think the way you see other people is really important to how your life goes. And the people who put people on pedestals are always trying to be something better. And the people who, you know, see people neutrally, you know, live really happy lives because they really respect, like, everybody.
Okay. Awesome. Not to change topics, but one thing I wanted to ask you about was the psychology of, like, Facebook and instant messaging and how that has changed today.
Yeah. Okay, so Facebook is really interesting because you kind of see people's attempts at perfection. Like, people want to be certain things and they want to display certain qualities. So, you know, like, before Facebook, you know, and still today, but, like, people, you know, dress, put makeup on, you know, they make their hair perfect, they wear the right clothes, and there's always this sort of attempt by people to be perfect. Everyone wants to have the guys all want Facebook profiles with, like, pictures of girls and alcohol, and not alcohol, but, like, they all want to be seen as, like, that cool, like, party guy, because that's what our society, like, encourages, like, right now. And the girls want to be seen as, like, really pretty and, you know, a lot of options. And so they go to parties with just the intention of, like, getting Facebook pictures almost. Like, it's like, how did they have time to be at the party, like, when they took 100 pictures at the party? Like, what did they do besides take pictures?
Like, so, you described to me, like, a Facebook depression almost that can arise from this.
Yeah. And so what happens is that people create this image for themselves on Facebook, which isn't bad because you always marketing yourself. You always want to come off a certain way, but you create a false person. And a lot of times when other people see that, they think it's a real person.
Right.
And so what's common nowadays is, like, Facebook depression is, you know, you sign on Facebook, you see all your friends out, you know, doing all these parties with all these cool people and stuff, and you're like, man, they're really living their life, and I'm not living your life. And in our society, like, there's this whole, like, thing, like, you know, you gotta live life to the fullest. Like, that's why we had that saying, that's why you had the saying YOLO, but you only live once, because there's this whole notion, I think it was kind of created by, like, our television culture, that, you know, you have to live life to the fullest, and apparently the people on Jersey Shore live life to the fullest. It's kind of funny, but everyone, like, attempts to do that, and if you don't play the game, then you get ostracized. So everyone plays this game, you can't get your way out of it, but gotcha. It's a stupid game for the most part, and I don't think it's really what brings, like, self-fulfillment and stuff.
But I would say clearly, though, like, today you kind of do need a Facebook, otherwise you just kind of look weird, or whenever I meet someone, the question always comes up, hey, do you have a Facebook? Can I add you on Facebook? And if you say no, they're like, what? Like, it's kind of weird.
Like, you think that they're like hiding something.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with having, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with necessarily, like, making your profile, like, perfect and, you know, looking great, but I think that people tend to not get along a lot of times because both people are trying to come off as something that they're not. And it's not, like, sincere and it's not real. And I think people who have really good relationships are open and honest about who they really are. What we were talking about before, we're talking about self-acceptance. Most of the people who have these Facebook profiles don't accept who they really are. Like, maybe they go out to parties just to get pictures of people, just so they can look cool on Facebook. And on Facebook, they're awesome. But in real life, they're really not having that much fun or anything. They're just getting drunk.
Yeah.
And those people, like, are in denial about who they actually are. And I think that it gets in the way of relationships when you're not true to who you really are and real. And I think people go overboard on Facebook with becoming a fake person that's not who they are, which in some ways is not necessarily bad, because you can have people who don't have much confidence and they can build their confidence through Facebook. But
okay.
It's kind of a double-edged sword. There's good stuff that comes from it and bad stuff, and there's weird stuff, like the fact that everyone takes so many pictures. It's like 2,000 pictures. What are you going to do, like, show this to your kids? Like, oh, this is me at the party getting drunk with 10 guys. Like, when you're, like, older. You can. It's very self-evident when you go on Facebook that people take pictures for other people to see and for other people to be envious of.
Right.
Because otherwise we wouldn't have 2,000 pictures.
Right, yeah.
So kind of switching topics, since we're kind of going through, like, the different forms of psychology, I want to get into the another type of psychology that was big 70s, 80s, and that was humanist perspective. There was definitely this bad thing going on with psychology, where psychologists were becoming too determined and believing that they could determine human behavior better than they could. Okay. They understood what people were doing better than they could. In reality, people are very complex, and we can't break them down to simple things. There's
simple equations.
Simple equations. There's more to people than that, and that's what the humanists argued, was that people have free will, that people make choices, and that, you know, people's ultimate goal is to become happy, to become a self-fulfilled person. You have Henry Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is like, you first need, you know, food, then you need like shelter, and then relationships, and then self-fulfillment's like the ultimate goal of people. And that's like sort of like an inner confidence to yourself. And so the humanist perspective was kind of that, you know, it doesn't necessarily help people to break down everything that they do. You know, like before I was talking about defense mechanisms, you know, determining why you have these cognitive errors. The humanist said that the reason why these people had these cognitive errors was because of, they didn't have positive relationships in their life that overrid these. So the psychologist then took on the role of a positive relationship. Like often a lot of times the problems that people have isn't so much like, you know, we all have like these defense mechanisms, we all have these flaws that we're blind to, but some of us function completely fine despite these in society. And well, you know, some of us have more and less of cognitive errors than others, but a big problem that a lot of people have is they just don't have someone to listen to them. And that's what the humanist said. Stephen Covey said, seek first to understand before being understood. And that wasn't original Stephen Covey. That came about, I mean, it may have came about before then, but this whole idea came about during the humanist psychology movement. There's a psychologist who, the name like fleets me right now, but his whole approach was seek first to understand before being understood. The psychologist just listened to the person and acted as another human being there. And it helped a lot of people.
Right. Now, okay, so let me ask you this. I was kind of confused. Why does it matter? Let's say the psychologist doesn't really say that much. Like, they say, okay. Why does it matter that it's another human being there as opposed to just like a brick wall? Like, what? I mean, you yourself are just saying the same things, the same words, but it's as if it has to be a human that's understanding you as opposed to just nothing understanding you.
Yeah, and I think that a humanist would argue that there's more to people than just these, we're not just meats of brain.
Right.
Meats and brain. Like, we are, there's something beyond that. There's something that's unmaterial, and that is what people like need from another person. They need that person, like as another soul, another person to listen to them, another person of understanding of what it means to be human and stuff like that.
Okay, so it's just the fact that the person feels as if one soul out there, one other person out there, actually understands what they're going through.
Yeah,
that is what helps them.
Yeah, and it's a complicated thing because like of course you have a dog and you can like express all your problems to the dog and the dog can then like make you feel better by listening, but it's only because we assign human qualities to that dog and we think that they actually listen to us when they actually don't.
Right,
and we can do that. Like humans have the capabilities of assigning humanness to non-human items and stuff and benefiting. Like I think in the movie Castaway, the guy turns the volleyball sort of into another person and sort of assigns human qualities to it. So
is that what we do with dolls, by the way, like or like toys when we're younger?
Or is that a different phenomenon? I mean, it might be. I just don't know. You know, I know children enjoy playing with dolls and stuff, and like acting like an adult towards a doll. Right. I think you're right. I think that they do assign human qualities to those dolls, and they act as like companions, or like they give the child the ability to pretend to be a parent. And I think that that's great because kids can like develop a lot of like skill sets when they're younger. That's probably the point of it.
Well, I actually think playing like when you're very young, like when you're playing with toys and you're enacting different roles, is extremely important because what you're doing is practicing how another person would react. Mm-hmm. You're like practicing the art of empathy or trying to see something from how another person's point of view. And if the better you are at that, the better feedback you have to interact with a person in a social environment. So I think playing is actually really important.
Definitely. I think exactly. I think that's why we've evolved to play.
Yeah.
Is that it is socially beneficial.
Right.
It helps us with that. And like you kind of into too, like how boys and girls play differently. Like, right. You give boys dolls and they use them as swords.
Exactly.
You give girls like trucks and they use them
as a car, transport something. So I agree with you. I think I also think there's like a societal imposed play that a girl or a boy is engaged
to. Social conditioning.
Right.
Yeah. A girl is expected to play a certain way.
Yeah, like it's Barbies and
it's an environment learned behavior. And that's a big debate is whether this stuff is environmentally learned or whether it's genetically. And I think that there's a lot of evidence to show that it's both.
Yeah.
There's pretty strong evidence to show that it's genetic. I mean, you've had situations where there's no like environmental like social conditioning influencing the person, and they still use like the boys take the dolls and they use them as swords.
Yeah,
but it made sense too, like evolutionary, that the childhood behavior shapes adult behavior, and the man cannot act like a woman right. to survive hundreds of years ago.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
he has, because he has more muscle mass, he has to develop the skills of being like a hunter gatherer.
Right,
a woman has to be develop nurturing skills.
Yeah,
in our society today, it's changed because it's not so necessary for those things to stay the same.
Yeah, exactly.
But you can't get rid of the genetic aspect to it. That's pretty self-evident.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I guess a biologist would argue is that the genetic aspect would change with time. Like, we would evolve, you know, because women, you know, women are just as qualified to work in jobs as men are now.
Yeah.
It's not like a hunter-gatherer position. It's more like an intellectual battle.
Yeah.
So the thing is that the women are just as qualified as men are, and that might change our genetic pool.
Yeah, over a long period of time, yeah, I think that will happen. It should happen if our theories are right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so another thing that kind of came from the humanist perspective was kind of mapping out the human life and what phases you go through. And this area was really interesting to me, like identity crisis. Like, you hear that word, that's kind of where it comes from. There's different times in your life where you face identity crisis. And probably the first major one is adolescence. And then the next big one is college. I always call the college one an existential crisis. Because what happens is I think that most people reach an intelligence level where they start questioning their worldview and how it maps out the world. They say, like, you know, if there's no God, then there's no meaning. We're just a small speck in an infinitely large universe that will be gone in a short period of time in the scheme of things. So no matter what I do, it doesn't matter. And so you start questioning all these things like that. Or you question, like, is there a God? Is there not a God? Is there meaning to anything? Is there not meaning? Do I have a purpose? And part of the reason why you start questioning in college is because now your independence is being pushed on you. You know, you no longer are dependent on your parents. And so you now have to make decisions for yourself in the real world. And so I call it the existential crisis because intellectual people, when they hit college, almost always become depressed. It's like inevitable. If you have a kid that's smart and they go to college, they're going to become depressed. Like, especially with the way our society is, like the partying that's encouraged in college and stuff. You know, everyone wants to say, like, oh, that's a great time. But for the intellectual people, they hit it and they're like, this is what is life about? Yeah. This doesn't make any sense. So I think, yeah, like, certain intelligences will hit this existential crisis of college. I think other people maybe hit it later on in life. And then there's obviously the identity crisis of, like, you know, turning 40 and going from, like, a young man to an older man and things like that. But a lot of the psychologists kind of mapped out the different phases that you go through. And it's pretty interesting because, you know, like, when I was reading this stuff, I was like, man, I'm going through that now. what's kind of interesting is there's a lot of research on this. Like, during college, people start forming sort of more of a concrete identity that moves on to the rest of their life. For example, they say that people often experiment with different identities, and then they choose one that's best. And they say people who end up being the happiest are ones who experiment with the most ideas and then choose the one that works best. I know that was the way I was. Like, I have a lot of regrets, like, the way I, like, was in high school and stuff. But in high school, I was, like, really trying a different identity out.
Mm.
And I've tried a lot of identities out, and I feel like I'm starting to pick an identity that I'm more and more happy with. It's slowly starting to concrete itself. You know, I think if you know anyone who's, like, an adolescent or college kid, you know, be okay with the fact that there's different identities. Like, the jock in high school who's a jerk to everybody, you know, he's doing that because of the social rewards he reaps from it. But don't just hate that person because he made that choice. Like, it's hard to say once you're in his shoes that, I mean, he may have just experimented with that. And that's a lot of times you see, like, the jerks in college, they slowly evolve into better people as they reshape their identity.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, I think that's all the time that we have for today's podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be sure to come back with a new episode next week. Thanks, guys.
Adios. Oh, yes.